Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom of Faith. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities.
Hello there. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host tonight on the Gist of Freedom show. Our special guest tonight is Professor Playfell Benjamin, who will be discussing with us the formation and history of the NAACP and the Niagara Movement, in addition to discussing a book that he co-authored called Reconsidering the Souls of Black Folks. Are you there yet, Professor?
Yes, I'm here. Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. Just a few comments to let our listeners know a little bit about Professor Benjamin, Playfell Benjamin. He is twice nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in two different categories, one being explanatory journalism when he was with the Village Voice in 1988, and also for distinguished commentary. I'm also enamored of an award that he received from Lincoln University here in the state of Missouri, the Unity Award, which was presented by the School of Communications at Lincoln University. From 1991 to 1996, Playfell was a regular contributor to the Guardian Observer of London. There he wrote on politics, culture, and sports. He also wrote for the Sunday Times of London, particularly in a prestigious magazine there, The Culture, which addressed cultural matters high and low. He's written important stories for the Village Voice. He's had commentaries. He has a website called The Commentaries on the Times, which I would suggest that our listeners get to as soon as they can after the show, and on the list goes. He praises saints, he celebrates heroes, he unmasks charlatans, he defends the defenseless, and chastises scoundrels. I think I'm going to cut it off right there now. Professor, is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, just that I've been a professor of history and professor of journalism. You know, I was a practicing journalist, and then I became a journalism professor, but I started out early on. I'm one of the co-founders of the first black studies department in the world that could actually grant degrees. There was a black studies program at San Francisco State, which started earlier, around 1968. But in 1969, we began building the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And, you know, it's now celebrating its, 42nd or 43rd anniversary. This was the first black studies department in the world that could actually grant a degree in black studies. And we named it after Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois because Dr. Du Bois is the greatest intellectual that the black race produced in the 20th century. We managed to get all of his papers, all of his voluminous papers, you know, at the university, and there's hundreds of letters, correspondences with the greatest people of the age, Albert Einstein, Mao Zedong of China, Mahatma Gandhi, Nehru. He has correspondences with all of the great personalities of his time. And, of course, Du Bois, so we named the department in his honor, and we got his papers there. So that's where I began as a professor in that department. And then I left and I went into the music business for a while, and I went into journalism. And then I ended up as a journalism professor. That was the last. And now I produce a radio commentary series that I have been producing now for over 20 years, WBI FM in New York City. It's a part of the Pacifica Network, and it can be heard online, streaming online in real time, which is 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. But you can access them online in the archives at WBAI.org for 90 days after they have been delivered. My commentary today was a commentary on Rush Limbaugh and his crazy, increasingly insane attacks on President Obama And the question I ask is his jealousy of Obama driving him crazy? And that can be heard if you just go to WBI.org and turn on the 6 o'clock news and listen to the newscast. You will eventually hear the commentary. So that's what I do. Prior to becoming a professor in 1969, I had a whole history in the actual struggle. I started in student demonstrations and when I was a freshman in college in the spring of 1960. I was in the student demonstrations from the very beginning. I knew Malcolm X very well. Of course, you know, I know Jesse Jackson and all of them, you know, had interactions with all of them. But Malcolm I knew very well, and a lot of other people who, like Queen Mother Moore and Reverend Dr. Leon Sullivan, great people that a lot of young people don't know about now, but who were among the greatest people of the 20th century. Okay. They were my teachers. They were the people I interacted with, and so what you get is the result of all of that.
And some of those people were instrumental in the formation of the NAACP?
Well, no. The NAACP is way, well, some of the people I mentioned, yes, W.E.B. Du Bois. W.E.B. Du Bois was the central figure in the founding of the Niagara Movement and the NAACP. The way I happened to get involved in this conversation was the sister, Ms. Geis, put up a picture on Facebook. And she asked for comments about it. Did anybody know where this picture came from? Who were these people? And when I saw it, I saw that it was a picture of the gathering at of the Niagara Movement in 1905, the first meeting of the Niagara Movement. And I put a statement online that if you really want to, if you'd like to know about this movement and its background and whatnot, read my book, Reconsidering the Souls of Black Folk. Reconsidering the Souls of Black Folk is a book that was written on the 100th anniversary of the publication of The Souls of Black Folk, which was written by Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. It was published in 1903. So our book was written on the 100th anniversary of the publication of the original text, which was April 18th, 1903. Our book came out in April of 2003.
Okay.
W.E.B. Du Bois was the best educated American of his time. He came from Great Barrington, Massachusetts, up in the mountains of western Massachusetts. He came from a small black community surrounded by white folks. People who see Dr. Du Bois in later years, and people like Marcus Garvey, for instance, who mistook Du Bois for the mixed-blood mulatto elite class in Jamaica that he had dealt with in Jamaica. When he saw Du Bois as a counterpart of this Jamaican class. But he didn't really understand America, nor did he understand race relations and the place of all black people in the American racial caste system. Because while Du Bois may have been light-skinned compared to Marcus Garvey, or light-skinned if he had gone to down to Jamaica, he would naturally have been viewed as a member of the light-skinned class, because in Jamaica and the Caribbean, the color system is quite different from in the United States. But in the United States, and the main difference is this, in the Caribbean where Marcus Garvey came from, you have basically a triple color caste system. You have whites, blacks, and mulattoes, that is mixed blood folk. You find this kind of distinction all throughout Latin America, especially in Brazil. But in the United States, there was never any official distinction, any official category that separate dark-skinned black people or unmixed Africans, if they was to say that, from light-skinned people or mixed blood or mulatto people or brown people, as they say in the Caribbean. So W.E.B. Du Bois came from a predominantly white community, and in this community, his nickname was Black Willie. So he had no kind of sense of any kind of light skin privilege or what have you, like the people in the Caribbean that Marcus Garvey mistook him for. In any case, Du Bois decided early on he wanted to fight for the advancement of his people. And he concluded that the best way he could do that was through the use of his intelligence. He would become a great scholar, and he would help guide our people forward by studying our problems and coming up with systematic policies to deal with them. So first he decided he had to prepare himself. And what a preparation he got.
Okay.
By the time he was 25 years old, he had completed the requirements for PhDs from both Harvard and the University of Berlin, the Kaiser Wilhelm University in Berlin, which was the greatest university in the world at the time.
Particularly by the time he was 25 years old?
25, yes. As a matter of fact, at 25, he wrote a dissertation for a PhD in economics in German. In German. And there was no white American who had a PhD in economics from the University of Berlin. None. And this is the reason why the white people, who were the trustees of the Slater Fund, a fund set up for the education of black youth, they withdrew his money just as he was about to take the PhD. He had done everything. He had written the thesis. He had defended the dissertation. But the university said he had done it so quick. Usually they require 6 semesters to get a doctorate.
Okay.
Du Bois did it in 3. And the reason he did it in 3 was because he had a limited amount of money, and he had to do it before his money ran out. So in 3 months, he wrote the dissertation and defended it. In my book, I have letters from his German professors that talk about how brilliant he was and how he had met all the requirements for the degree, but the other professors in the university protested. They said, you know, we can't have an American come here and totally change the rules of the university. You know, it's always
right.
been 6 semesters. We can't let him come here and take it. So, and this wasn't a racial thing. Well, it was nothing like the racial situation in the United States. I mean, I could talk about that later. I mean, I can't say that there was
right.
no race involved in it, but that wasn't the main question. In any case, Du Bois just needed enough money to stay one more semester, just to stay around campus. They made a compromise. They said, okay, if he stays 2/3 of the time, we'll give him the doctorate. He'd done all the work on it. He just needed $350 to stay for another semester, and he was just going to spend the time traveling around Germany and traveling around Europe. And the Slater Fund refused to give him the money. So he had to leave before he could actually take the degree, even though the Germans called him back and gave it to him 50 years later.
So, was his entire education supported by the State Department?
Not by the State Department, the Slater Fund, which was a private fund.
Oh, that's okay.
You know, it had not. The Slater Fund. And it was set up by a guy named John Slater. He put $1 million in a fund for the education of black youth. Now, $1 million in the late 19th century was a lot of money. What he says is, when you read about him, what he says, he was in the sugar business, right? And
yeah.
he decided to put up this money for the education of black youth. Well, if you were in the sugar business in the 19th century, you were in the slave business. So I think that this guy was... You know, his conscience was bothering him about all the dirt he had done to black people, so he set up this fund of $1 million. And all Du Bois needed was another $350, so it wasn't a matter of money. When I looked at the internal records from the Slater Fund many years later when I was doing this book, I discovered that the real reason they wouldn't give him the money is they said, they had a meeting, and they said, look, this colored boy already has finished the requirements for a degree from Harvard in history and sociology. No white American has a doctorate in economics from the Kaiser Wilhelm University in Germany, in Berlin. If he takes this degree, he will have 2 PhDs from the greatest American university and the greatest European university, possibly the greatest university in the world. And a Negro with these kind of educational credentials will be nothing but trouble. Because he will never be willing to accept a position that a Negro must accept in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason that they denied giving him the last money. Now, in this period, this is like 1897, 1898, because in 1898, Du Bois came back, and within a year, he had written the first great sociological study in the history of the United States, and this is the Philadelphia Negro. This is the first great sociological study because it's important to understand that W.E.B. Du Bois studied with the greatest scholars in the world in his field in his time. At Harvard, he studied with the person that created the modern historical method of research, historical research. In Germany, he studied with Max Weber, who was the father of sociology. and, of course, the two great professors of political economy that he did the doctorate under. So he had the best education that money could buy. In fact, he describes himself when he came back to the United States in 1897. He said, "I was educated within an inch of my life."
Wow.
And when he was in Germany, he was a star. You know, he wasn't, you know, like pushed aside because he was black like he was here. German professors used to come and ask him to take their daughters out. You know,
yeah.
They would ask him to dance with their wives at parties. He was handsome, he was dashing, he was brilliant. He was an elegant dresser, and he came from the black working class, you know, of Great Barrington, Massachusetts. One of the great men of the 20th century, the greatest American intellectual, humanist intellectual of the 20th century, and somebody that our young people need to be patterning themselves after rather than Snoop Dogg and these clowns, you know. They need to be patterning themselves after really great men. Du Bois eventually was able to debate in seven languages. You know what I'm saying? This is the guy who was the moving force in both the Niagara Movement and the NAACP.
The Niagara Movement, so the NAACP grew out of the Niagara Movement.
Well, it grew out of the Niagara Movement and a group of white people of conscience, white liberals, socialists, who were outraged about the racial situation in the United States, the particular incident that caused them, because the call came from these white liberals to the black community, and members of the Niagara Movement answered the call. But what sparked the call from was Mary White Ovington, Oswald Willard Garrison, Wallington. Basically, they were Anglo-Saxons. One of the things that caused me to get involved in this discussion on when she put the picture up on the stage was that one guy said, "Oh, the NAACP was organized by Jews and black people had nothing." It's nonsense. You know, there were no Jews in the original organizers of the NAACP. Oswald Gilbert Garrison, William English Walling, and Mary White Ovington were all white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. As a matter of fact, Oswald Gilbert Garrison, who was a very rich and powerful man, was the grandson of William Lloyd Garrison, the great abolitionist of the 19th century, who was a colleague of Frederick Douglass's. And in fact, at the time of the Niagara, at the beginning of the Niagara Movement in 1905, it's important to understand what the racial climate was like in the United States. You know, and what was the state of black leadership? Because there are people who complain about the role that white people played in the NAACP. The NAACP would never have been possible if they didn't have white allies. W.E.B. Du Bois went down to Fisk University. He went to Fisk, the undergraduate school. He had a scholarship. He could have gone to Harvard right out of high school. But what kept him from going to Harvard out of high school was a group of singers from the South came to. And I don't think it may have been the Fisk Jubilee Singers. I'm not certain whether this particular group was, but it was a group from Fisk. I don't know whether it was the original Fisk Jubilee Singers, which I'll talk more about, but he heard them. And he heard them singing Afro-American spirituals, songs that we don't hear much anymore now. We hear a lot of gospel songs, but songs like Go Down Moses, you know, Let My People Go. Nobody Knows the Troubles I've Seen. I Couldn't Hear Nobody Pray. Sometimes I feel like a mother's child. These various songs, which were the sacred movement, sacred music of the slaves. This is the music that Afro-American slaves created, and it was the first great music created on American soil, the first original music created on American soil. And for instance, in 1895, when the white elite, cultural elite, decided to bring in a great European composer and have him look at the American cultural scene and develop a classical music based on, you know, American musical ingredients, they brought in Antonin Dvorak, a great Bohemian composer, and he came here, and after he studied a while, he lived here in New York, he met a group of Afro-American musicians, James Welland, J. Rosamond Johnson, and this whole group of black, Harry T. Burley, James Reese Europe, all of these people, Will Marion Cook, these well-trained Afro-American musicians who were trained in European music, but they were also real students of Afro-American music, and they introduced Dvorak to these spirituals, to this you know, original body of work which Du Bois wrote the first great essay on, called Of the Sorrow Songs, which is one of the essays in the Souls of Black Folk, one of the most beautiful essays ever written. It's written about this music. But when Dvořák looked at it, when he surveyed the American musical scene, he said that the music, the great music, where the great music in America was going to come from was going to be from Afro-Americans. And if you look at his Symphony from the New World, which is a famous composition, one of the famous compositions of the 19th century, when you listen to Symphony from the New World, you hear these Afro-American spiritual themes woven all through the symphony. You know, you can see the, you know, the, what he thought about, you know, the Afro-American influence. Well, Du Bois heard this music in the 1890s as a kid. 1885, in fact, he went to, and he decided that, you know, later for Harvard, I want to go to the land of slavery. I want to go where my people were slaves. I want to go where the people created this magnificent, haunting music. And so he went to Fisk. And he describes in detail what it was like when he first walked on Fisk campus and saw Jubilee Hall, which was built from the money raised by the Jubilee singers when they traveled to Europe and performed before Queen Victoria and what have you. So Du Bois was swept up in the beauty, the majesty, spirituality of black culture. The white folks lost him right there, you know. And
yeah.
He committed himself, you know, to his life, to uplifting the black race, you know. And so he attempted to do it first as a scholar. The first scientific history written of Afro-Americans, published about Afro-Americans, is The Suppression of the Slave Trade, which was Du Bois' 1895 PhD thesis at Harvard, which became the first volume of the Harvard University New World Historical Studies. It was the first scientific history produced, documenting the history of black Americans. So Du Bois was the father of Afro-American historiography, that is, the scientific writing of Afro-American history, but he was soon supplanted in that role by Cotter G. Woodson. But he also was the father of American sociology. So in any case, he went down to Fisk. He encountered black people in the South. He met many people who had been slaves. He interviewed them. In fact, in The Souls of Black Folk, there's several essays on the meaning of freedom is one of them, you know, where he talks about his interaction with former slaves, staying among them, talking among them. And, you know, he decided that, on the night of his 25th birthday, he was in Berlin. He decided to have this private ritual and take an oath to life. So he locked himself in his room. He made a portion of Greek wine, oranges, and salt, and he started singing Afro-American spirituals. He would turn to the east and sing one, and he would turn to the west and sing one. And he did this all night long. And with the coming of sunrise, he wrote his commitment to life. He said, "Either I am a genius or I'm insane.
Mm-hmm.
But I shall emerge a mighty black giant, and kings shall bow before my scepter. I shall distinguish myself in science and the arts, and I will devote myself to the development of the colored peoples of the world, because I believe that in their development lies the development of the very best of mankind. And if in this attempt I should perish, I perish." Now, he was 25 when he wrote that.
And
you know,
if you can believe it, you can achieve it.
And he did it all his life. Du Bois lived to be 95 years old. You know, he died a few hours before the Great March on Washington in 1963 in Ghana. At the time, he was working on the 72-volume Encyclopedia Africana, a great encyclopedia of the whole black race, which was projected to be 72 volumes. And he was 95, you know, and he died literally on his typewriter. But in 1905, he was the principal moving figure and calling together a group of talented and highly educated and industrious black people, basically to oppose the growing domination of the philosophy of Booker T. Washington. Now, let me say a bit about Booker T. Washington, who was the other great figure here. Well, first of all, in the 19th century, up until 1895, the principal spokesman for Afro-Americans was Frederick Douglass. Now, it's not to say that there were not other people who were involved, but Frederick Douglass was the preeminent spokesman for black people in America. He died in 1895, the same year that Booker T. Washington was invited to speak to the World Exposition of Cotton Growing States in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, both Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington were ex-slaves. Both of them were the children of white men who raped their slave mothers.
Okay.
Both of them were absolutely committed to uplifting the black race. Frederick Douglass escaped from slavery as a young man. Booker T. Washington was 9 years old when slavery ended. Both of them had seen their masters read from books and was fascinated by it. Booker T. Washington, for instance, thought the book was talking to his master, and when he left the room, he went and picked up the book to see if it would talk to him. Frederick Douglass figured out pretty early on what writing was about and learned to write by tricking the master's kids into spelling out words for him in the sand. The mistress of the plantation saw him doing this one day, and she was intrigued with the idea that a nigger could learn to read. So she began to teach him to read, to see how far he could go. And one day, the master happened upon them. This is Douglas's father now, you understand what I'm saying? Happened upon him teaching him to read, and he snatched the book out of her hand and said, "What is the matter with you? Don't you know that knowledge, education unsuits a nigger for slavery?" That was the motive force of Douglass's life. He never forgot that. That education unsuits you for slavery. Frederick Douglass ended up being the most brilliant commentator on events of his time in the 19th century, latter half of the 19th century. If you look on my blog, you'll see, if you look in the section that's called Mission Statement, you will see that he's one of my great inspirations. And what I do now, in writing commentaries on the Times, is I view as a direct extension of what Frederick Douglass did in Frederick Douglass's paper. He used to put out a newspaper. But he constantly wrote these commentaries, these editorials. If you look at the life and writings of Frederick Douglass, edited by Professor Philip Foner, they cover 5 volumes.
Okay.
He wrote about everything that was going on of importance, just like I do. You know, and he was my great hero and inspiration. Now, he died in 1895. Okay, this is 1895. It's 30 years after the end of the Civil War. To really understand what was going on, you have to understand what happened with the Civil War and its aftermath. And I will try to put this very briefly.
Okay.
The American Civil War was the most destructive, deadly war in the history of the world at that time. It was the first modern war. And when I say modern war, I mean it was the first war in which men and material were moved around on railroads. It was the first war in which munitions were mass-produced in factories. It was the first war in which there was rifled cannon. When I say rifled cannon, what I mean is that in Napoleon Bonaparte's time, for instance, in the 18th century, when you fired a cannon was just a tube, you know, like a ball that you catapult out of it that might hit the target and might not.
It might not, yeah.
But rifle cannon was cannon that had riflery inside, rifle works. The reason that, the reason you can hit a rifle, hit things with such precision with a rifle, is because it has this network of grooves inside the barrel. It's called riflery. And it causes the projectiles to spin with accuracy, and that's how you can hit, you know, targets accurately. Well, in the American Civil War, they introduced rifle cannon, which means that they could hit what they were shooting at almost, you know, precisely from almost a mile away. That's why the American Civil War was so destructive. You had more people killed at the Battle of Gettysburg than had been killed in all of the Iraq War. The American Civil War was a very deadly, dangerous, destructive thing, which went on for 4 years. They thought it was going to be over in a few weeks, but it went on for 4 years. And during this time, Abraham Lincoln was implored many times by people in his own party to listen. Let's come to terms with the Rebs, you know. We're going to destroy the whole nation. Let's come. But Lincoln had become convinced that the Civil War was God's punishment of America for the sin of slavery, and he was determined to see it through if he was the last man standing. And he spent his evenings reading the great King James, the great prose in the King James Bible and William Shakespeare, which is why when you see his speeches, a speech like the Gettysburg Address, which he wrote all of his own speeches, just like Frederick Douglass.
Lincoln wrote his own speeches?
Oh, absolutely wrote his own speeches, you know. But Lincoln used to spend his evenings reading Shakespeare in the King James Bible, you know, and you see it reflected in the elegant prose, you know, of his speeches. So absolutely wrote his own speeches. Abraham Lincoln was a great man in a lot of ways. You know, and he befriended Frederick Douglass. You know, they eventually became friends. But the thing is that the Civil War, the South started the Civil War. It caught the North off guard. If another president, if a weaker president had been there, they might have managed to get away. But Abraham Lincoln said, you know, this war is to determine whether government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall perish from the earth. This is the only experiment of this kind going on in the world. If we lose it here, we may never see it again. You know, so he was prepared to fight to the bitter end to preserve the Union. And, of course, when the war was over, it was not clear what to do about black folk, because in the beginning of the Civil War, this was not an abolitionist war in the beginning. The South thought it was, but Abraham Lincoln had no intention of overthrowing slavery. He disagreed with it, and this is where people misunderstand Lincoln. He disagreed with slavery, but he was a lawyer, you know, and he was one of the fathers of American corporate law, you know. So he was, you know, very respectful of property rights. However, he disdained the system of slavery, and when the South rose up, he saw an opportunity to end slavery, and he was determined to pursue the war until the end. But nobody had decided what to do about black folks once these 4 million black people were free, what to do about them. And when the war was over, there were various proposals. Thaddeus Stevens, a congressman from Pennsylvania, wanted to treat the South like any other conquered nation. You know, so did Charles Sumner, the senator from Massachusetts, who became the point man in the establishment of radical Reconstruction. But Abraham Lincoln, before he was assassinated, and he was assassinated, you know, soon after the end of the war, but he had said, with malice towards none and charity for all, we shall bind the wounds of the nation, bind up the wounds of the nation. He just wanted it over with, and let's try to come back together and move on. But the South was these southern diehard rednecks, just like now. And this is, see, the interesting thing about all of this is the recurrent pattern of racial progress and retrogression in American civilization, because right now, in 2012, we are, and I don't want to be misunderstood about this, all right, but with all of the changes that have occurred, like, for instance, the attempt to suppress the vote, you know, all of this happened in the period following the Civil War. And it was the Reconstruction, the radical Reconstruction regime that was set up, that passed the Civil Rights Amendments, the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, the 15th Amendment extending us the right to vote. All of those things, 7 civil rights bills were passed in this period. This was an attempt to really put the ex-slaves on an equal footing with white folks. However, by the 1890s, started in the 1870s, first with the sellout of Reconstruction, what's known as the Compromise of 1876, which effectively ended radical Reconstruction, and then a period set in that the great black historian Rayford Logan calls the nadir, the lowest point in Afro-American history, from around, you know, 1895 to 1885 to 1915. This is the period that, in which Du Bois went down in 1885 to study at Fisk. This is the period in 1881 when Booker T. Washington founded Tuskegee Institute. And by the time Frederick Douglass died in 1895, 30 years after the end of the Civil War, Booker T. Washington was called upon to speak at the greatest event the South had held since the end of the Civil War. It was called a World Exposition of Cotton-Growing States. It was like a world fair organized by the former Confederate states. And the purpose was to show northern industry and industry from other parts of the world that we are now, you know, a restored and civilized society. It is safe to invest here. For instance, you know, you had all of this steel and coal ore down in Alabama. That's why Birmingham, Alabama would become a steel production center. with Andrew Carnegie, you know, in the United States Steel. But Andrew Carnegie wanted peace. Everybody, it is a rule that capital seeks a tranquil environment. That is to say that no business people want to invest anywhere where there's likely to be a war. And
so,
nobody wants to. Yes.
Excuse me a minute.
Yes.
How is it then that the Niagara movement got their intellect energized, or didn't, because there was a debate between Booker T. Washington. He seemed to have gotten more support from
the
establishment.
Well, this is the point I'm getting to right now. This is the point I'm getting to. I'm going to explain to you how Booker T. Washington got the support of the captains of industry, the richest men in America. This is what I'm saying, that in the aftermath of the Civil War, the South had a lot of natural resources, you know, that kind of thing, like in Alabama, all this iron ore, coal and whatnot. And the industry, northern industry, wanted to come down there and exploit it, but they didn't want to come down there if there's going to be a race war going on. They didn't want to try to build a business in the midst of a race war. So they were looking for a leader who could pacify the situation, who could work with the white South, you know, and they were going to see to it. Once they decided that, okay, this is the program we want, they were going to make the white South go along with it, because the white South was devastated, you know, and they were trying to build themselves back. The North was flourishing. You know, the North was industrial. The South was a big agricultural extended plantation. It was trying to move towards industrialization and develop economically the way the North had developed. So they were looking for a person who could reason with these white Southerners, a black person that could come up with a program that could get along. So Booker T. Washington in Tuskegee.
Okay, and there were more blacks in the South than there were whites at the time.
Well, not really. There's never been more blacks anywhere in this country than there was whites. The only place there's ever been where blacks have ever outnumbered whites is in South Carolina in the 18th century and some parts into the 19th century. In the early 1700s, blacks outnumbered whites in South Carolina 3-1 at one point. But basically in South Carolina, even by the time of the Civil War, you had a very large population in some parts of the black population. They were so many of them, they lived off in isolation from whites. That's why when you see what they call the Gullah culture.
So why was the South so in fear of voting rights?
I beg your pardon?
Why was the
Well, one of the reasons the South was so in fear of voting rights is because many of white Southerners had been disfranchised. They couldn't vote as a result of their participation in the Civil War. You see, so many of them couldn't vote, you know, at the time that black people got to vote. Plus, there were certain areas, certain counties where black people were in the black belt, like, for instance, in Lowndes County, even in 1960, where the Black Panther Party began, black people were the majority in that county. But black people were not the majority in the entire South, but they were the majority in certain areas where they could elect people to Congress. Like, for instance, you know, if you look at the picture of the black Republicans, the first black of the black Republicans was Joseph H. Rainey Sr., who came from South Carolina. So you had, about six black congressmen, two black senators, Hiram Revels and Blanche Kelso Bruce. The thing is that the fear of the black vote was the fact that the black vote was attached to the Republican Party. And everybody who was a Republican, when the blacks combined with white Republicans, they could dominate the electoral process. The Republican Party was the party of Abraham Lincoln. Right? It's not the Republican Party today. The Republican Party today is the party of Lincoln Continental. All right, and the Republican Party today is the party of the racist right cracker South. That's where the redneck crackers went when they left the Democratic Party after Johnson signed the Civil Rights Bill in 1964. But back to the Niagara Movement. The Niagara Movement began because black intellectuals like W.E.B. Du Bois, like John Hope, who was the president of Atlanta University, like William Monroe Trotter, you know, who was a journalist that had also graduated from Harvard in a real estate land in Boston. They detested Booker T. Washington's program, which was enumerated in which I was getting ready to tell you at the World Exposition of Cotton Growing States in 1895. in Atlanta. This is how Booker T. Washington became the darling of the white capitalist class. Booker T. Washington made a speech in which he said the following. He said, this is the piece, that, this is what caught everybody's eye, or everybody's ears, when he said, in all things that are purely social, we can be as part as the fingers of the hand. But in all things that are essential to mutual progress, we must be one as the fist. The wisest men among my race understand that agitation on such, that it is far more important to be able to make a dollar at a factory than spend a dollar in an opera house. And the wisest men among my race view agitations on questions of social and political equality to be the extremist folly. Okay? So in the speech, what Booker T. Washington did was say to the white South, if you allow us to survive. Now, mind you now, he's living in a situation where black people are being lynched, that is, shot, hung, burned alive every 2.5 days from 1882 to 1915. All right? This is serious business. All right? He was in the middle of a race war when the white South was taking out its anger on black folk after the end of radical reconstruction in 1876 when they moved all the federal troops out of the South. Because radical reconstruction was characterized by dividing the South up into 5 military districts, placing each one under the command of a Union general. And you had a lot of black soldiers walking around with bayonets down there enforcing the reconstruction laws. But in 1876, in the Hilton Hayes election, when they, the great compromise of 1876, what they agreed to take out all of the soldiers out of the South and turn the South back over to the states' rights rulers. That's why right now today, you know, the hatred of the federal government, all the talk about, you know, the anti-government, all this anti-government stuff you hear, you look at where it emanates from, you know, and that is because the federal government's constant intervention on behalf of black folk is what first broke up slavery and then broke up segregation. However, in 1905, segregation was the law of the land because of the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896. The Plessy versus Ferguson decision interpreted the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution in such a way that it made segregation legal. This clause was intended to protect the freedom.
I'd like to get back to the to the opera comment.
Which opera?
Very intriguing. Where we're spending more dollars in the opera houses.
Well, what he said was,
these are houses that we didn't even own.
Well, he's talking about opera houses. He's talking about theaters where they had opera.
Yeah, theaters. Opera.
Yeah. And he was saying that. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, whereas Du Bois thought that we would be better off spending our money sitting next to white folks.
Well, that's nonsense. That's just a total misunderstanding of what happened. That's nonsense, all right? The question wasn't, the question was this. The question was, were black people going to have the same rights, the ex-slaves going to have the same rights as all other people in America, the same rights as white people, or whether we were going to be a caste shut aside by law and shut off into some, you know, back alley places and not allowed to exercise our full rights. I grew up under segregation in the South. You're saying anybody who want to romanticize that shit, you know, they're out of their mind. There's nothing romantic about it. There were a lot of black businesses and all that kind of stuff, but the price we had to pay for it, you know, in terms of our human dignity, is the reason why black people rose up against that. And then Booker T. Washington was what Booker T. Washington was saying. The question that the white South wanted to hear, what was important to them was, is whether or not we wanted to be their equals. And Booker T. Washington was saying to them, no, we will accept an inferior social status if you just let us live.
Okay.
If you just allow us to make a living and live.
It was Booker T. that made that fifth statement, the fingers on a hand.
That was the speech I just said. What he said to them is that in all things purely social, that is, you know, going to an opera house, going to a theater, going hanging out in the park. When I was a kid in the South in Florida, you couldn't even sit in the public parks. Never mind even think about going to a public beach or a public pool or anything. And we are citizens.
Mm-hmm.
We're American citizens. We're paying taxes for this, right? But the white South, at the end of the Civil War, what they were concerned about was whether black people wanted full social equality, because in their mind that meant white black men screwing white women the way they had been screwing black women all the centuries. You know, and Booker T. Washington understood that because he was a Southerner. Du Bois was not a Southerner. Neither was Monroe Trotter. You understand what I'm saying? Even though Du Bois was working in the South at the time at Atlanta University, holding these great, we had to set up this great research project there. But Du Bois, it was both the abdication of full political rights, including the right to vote. Booker T. Washington gave up the right to vote in this speech. So it was. This was a question over, first of all, whether or not we were going to exercise full political and social rights. The other question was, what kind of education were black youth going to get? Booker T. Washington developed a model called industrial education, where it best expressed, and I go into all this in my book, and best expressed in a statement by Colonel Armstrong, General Armstrong, who was the founder of Hampton Institute, where Booker T. Washington went to school, in one of the great conferences to decide the educational policy for black kids, the founder of Hampton, General Armstrong, said that black people should be taught to be educated of heart and hand. We should be taught how to work with our hands and love white people in our heart.
Professor, excuse me.
Yeah.
Can you reiterate or repeat again what Booker T. said that indicated he didn't want the right to vote?
He said, in all things that are purely social, we can be separate as the fingers of a hand. But in all things that are essential to mutual progress, we must be one as the fist. The wisest men among my race understand that agitation on questions of social and political equality is the extremist folly. That's the statement right there.
Okay.
You understand what I'm saying? You know, and we consider it infinitely more important just now that a colored man be able to make a dollar in a factory rather than spend a dollar in an opera house. This was, Du Bois called the speech the Great Atlanta Compromise and attacked it, okay? And Frederick Douglass would have attacked it too, but Frederick Douglass died just before the speech was made. William Monroe Trotter was outraged by it. And it was these educated black men, highly educated black men, who said two things. They said, if we give up our right to vote, it doesn't matter whether we accumulate any money because we won't be able to protect it.
So,
Du Bois said, if you teach people just how to make money, you may produce a group of moneymakers, but you will not produce men. Okay, there's something more to being a man, you know, than just making money. It was these black people who were outraged, Garrett Morgan, the outrage about what was going on, that met at the 1905 Niagara Movement. This is how the Niagara Movement began. It was a protest against the ideology of Booker T. Washington and what became known as the Tuskegee Machine. Now, the Tuskegee Machine was the Booker T. Washington became the darling of the captains of industry. He absolutely mesmerized Andrew Carnegie, who was the richest man in the world. Andrew Carnegie was the creator of the first billion-dollar corporation, United States Steel. Now, when they talk about Mitt Romney, for instance, today, and talk about what a great businessman, Mitt Romney is a lightweight when it comes to great businessmen. Mitt Romney's fortune is about half of what Puff Daddy's is. Puff Daddy got twice as much money as Mitt. Puff Daddy's fortune is estimated around $546 million. Jay-Z is the CEO of a billion-dollar corporation, and he came out of the projects, reefer dealer. So Mitt Romney is greatly overestimated in terms of his acumen as a businessman. I've written about this. You should read. I have a piece up on my blog called "Is Mitt a Better Businessman Than Jay-Z?" You should read it. You
know, what was the name of that again?
Is Mitt a Better Businessman Than Jay-Z? You know, it's on my blog. The thing is that people like Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Henry Ford, these people were real captains of industry. That is, they created these businesses, and they made great fortunes, but they employed millions of people. What Mitt Romney does in private equity, they're not interested in employing anybody. They buy up companies and tear them apart and make money off it and throw the workers on the street. So it's a different, whole different thing. But this is the beginning of the American, great American Industrial Revolution. This is when American industry began to rise and become the most powerful in the world, which by the end of World War II it was.
Well, in today's view, do you think that J.C. and Puff are exhibiting more of Booker T or W.E.'s philosophy?
Well, really neither one. I mean, because this is a different world. You know, I mean, they live in a completely different world. I mean, these guys, first of all, neither one of them are particularly race conscious. You know, I mean, so-so, but not like the people that we're talking about here. You know, these people were absolute race men. You know, they were dedicated to, you know, uplifting the race. I mean, Puffy and them, you know, they've come along at a time where this is a completely different world. I mean, when Booker T and W.E.B. Du Bois, if W.E.B. Du Bois came along today, he wouldn't be able to accept all the offers that he was offered. I'm talking about from top American universities, Harvard, Yale, Princeton. He wouldn't have been able to accept all the offers he'd be getting. But he wasn't even given. When he went to the University of Pennsylvania, when they hired him to do this great study, which became the first great classic in American sociology, the Philadelphia Negro, they wouldn't even give him an office on campus. They gave him an assistant instructor's position, assistant instructor, and he was the most educated man in America.
Which philosophy do you think is holding sway today?
Well, it's a different world, you know what I mean? These are the same. We're not dealing with the same questions at all. You know, it's a different world. I mean, listen, we're talking about a period where no matter who you were, what kind of education you had, what kind of accomplishments you had, you were a nigger, and you were subject by law to discrimination. There were jobs you could not hold, which were almost every job was closed to you, professional job. You couldn't live where you wanted to. Most of the country black folk couldn't even vote. Today, if you are a highly educated, rich black person, you can do anything you want to do. You can be president of the United States.
But
if you had told W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington that there would be a black president of the United States, a black family in the White House now, they would have thought you were a madman and called to have you locked up. It was inconceivable.
We've made gains on that front, but we don't have hospitals, we don't have newspapers. You know, I think
we don't need hospitals or newspapers. We needed hospitals and newspapers. We have newspapers. We got a newspaper here in New York. We got the Amsterdam News. It's been here ever since, you know, back in the 1920s. But we have newspapers. Nothing is stopping black people from having newspapers, you know. If black people want to have newspapers, they can have newspapers. The reason we don't have newspapers now the way we used to have newspapers then is because in those days, white papers would not cover black people, period. So if you were going to get any news about black folk, you had to have your own press. That's not true now. You know, black people are covered in the press like everybody else. It's not the same world. It's impossible to draw those kind of parallels. You know, this is a different world. The problems are totally different. There's some problems that are the same. One of the problems that's the same is that the white South still wants to suppress the black vote. The white South still wants to resist the federal government, you know, to enforce standards on the white South. But, I mean, all across the South, you have black mayors, black sheriffs, black, you know, legislators. None of that existed. None of that was possible, you know. We were living in a completely different world, a totally different world then. But let me just get back to the Niagara Movement. So the Niagara Movement was a reaction to Booker T. Washington and the Tuskegee Machine. And what they meant by the Tuskegee Machine was this. The white industrialists who surrounded Booker T. Washington, they gave so much money to Tuskegee. In 1910, Tuskegee's endowment was bigger than that of Vanderbilt's. Vanderbilt today is one of the richest universities in the South. But 1910, Tuskegee had more money than them.
So you think we're in need of a Tuskegee machine today?
No, because what Booker T. Washington did was to use his power to determine which black person would be allowed to advance anywhere in the country. And if you disagreed with him, you know, and you were up for any kind of important position, he could kill it. And he did. You know, that's why they hated the Tuskegee machine. That's why they organized against it. That's why they organized the Niagara movement against him, you know, because he had all of this power. Power corrupts. I believe power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. You know, I'm not in favor of any one person having any kind of monopoly over what we say or do at all. You know what I mean? We are far better off now. We have many voices now, you know, and everybody is free to pursue their own. Let me tell you something. In America today, the number one problem that black folk can face in this country today is getting a great education.
Well, don't you think that a lot of our charter schools are race-based and being financed by taxes that we all pay? Hello?
I come from a family of educators, four generations of them. I believe in the public schools. I look at my sister spent almost 50 years in public education.
But public schools are becoming a thing of the past, aren't they?
Well, if we allow public schools to become a thing of the past, we will live to regret it.
I mean,
we will live to regret it, right? Because charter schools, there's absolutely no evidence that charter schools are performing better than public schools. None. There is one here and there that you may find, but the evidence shows that overall there's no evidence of that. And not only that, but what our kids need to be trying to do is get into the best public schools, like here in New York City, for instance. You know, we have public schools here in New York City that are better than any private school anywhere in the world, period. You understand? There's no private school in the world that can compare with Stuyvesant High School.
New York may be the exception.
There's no private school. Well, yeah, but any community can do it. I tell you this, you don't hear no whole lot of talk about no charter schools in the suburbs. In fact, you don't hardly hear anything about charter schools in the suburbs because they have great public school systems. That's why. You know, I do not believe that charter schools is a viable substitute for the public school system, period. I just don't believe it, all right? Now, there may be some exceptional cases. There are always exceptions to the rule. But here's the problem with charter schools. There's several problems with them, you know. First one is they're not unionized. I'm not in favor of nothing that's not unionized, okay? Because if you don't have a union, you have no way of protecting yourself. And if you have no way of protecting yourself, you're not going to get the best and brightest people going into a profession where they have no rights. Nobody's going to do that. So what you will do is, if you set up a system where you take away all the rights from the teachers, they're no longer treated as professionals, then the best people won't go into the school system. They won't even think about becoming teachers. When I was a kid, I had great public school teachers. That's the reason why I can speak the English language the way I can. That's the reason I can write the way I can. That's the reason why I've had the wonderful life that I've had. When I look at my life, I started on the course of being who I am from early on in the public schools, and I could name the teachers who inspired me and taught me, you know, and who were responsible for who I am. You know, so I've heard the charter school debate. I just got through writing a book with a guy, and she goes into these charter schools or whatever.
Were the teachers black or white?
All my teachers were black. But all my kids' teachers were white here in New York, and they treated them as good as my black teachers treated me because they went to a school where the teachers cared about whether they went to public schools. But they went to public schools that were academically oriented, which means that parents have to do their job so you can get your kids into these schools. My kids were offered all kinds of scholarships to go to private schools. I turned them all down, all of them, because I don't want them going to some school on some scholarship, some ritzy private school, where they then become the poor ghetto kids, you know, later for that, you know. My kids went to schools that were integrated economically and ethnically. And the parents who put their kids in these schools put them in these schools because they wanted them to have the kind of multicultural integrated education that they got.
Do you think Du Bois or Booker would approve of that system?
Well, but you see, it's not a fair question because Booker T. Washington was living in a... See, let me just say this. The way this whole conversation started, the way I got involved in this whole thing is that I was trying to tell people that you cannot look at historical events outside of their context. Historical events have to be looked at in context, okay? Booker T. Washington was for was dictated by the historical context, by the times in which he lived. He lived in a time when the Supreme Court had ruled segregation was legal. He lived in a time when black people were being murdered, lynched, every 2.5 days in the black belt of the South where he was. These are the things, the conditions that shaped, in which he shaped his idea of what black possibility was. W.E.B. Du Bois, as late as 1934, because the NAACP was founded just 4 years after the first Niagara meeting was in 1905, and 1909 the NAACP was founded, and I'll talk about why in a minute, but the thing is that Du Bois, in 1934, he was one of the founders of the NAACP, but he was forced out of the NAACP in 1934 because he...
Minorities are gaining wealth off the backs of black folks in our neighborhoods, and that would probably be an abomination to Booker T.
Yeah, but you see, it's not just in our... If you look into kind of businesses that... Well, here in New York, for instance... You look at the kind of business that these, first of all, take the neighborhood I live in. The neighborhood I live in is an area called Sugar Hill. This was a very fabulous black area. I live in an apartment that Paul Robeson used to live in. And W.E.B. Du Bois used to live in a building right down the hall, the street. And Duke Ellington lives around the corner. And Johnny Hodges lived right down the hall from here. Andy Kirk. I mean, these were the elite buildings here, you know, in the 1920s, 19 Sugar Hill. Now, the building I live in is 120 apartments. It's a beautiful building, and it's owned by black owners. But the neighborhood has, first of all, had a great influx of Dominicans from the Dominican Republic, and now white folks. So when the Dominicans moved here in large numbers, they opened businesses because they're serving a community who are looking for products that no other businesses offer. So they opened them because they had a market here. So in black Americans are Americans. Black Americans who go to school to study business don't go to school to study how to run a corner store. They go to school to study how to run General Motors, you know. And if they don't want to run General Motors, they set up their own businesses, but they're not setting up corner stores, you know. They're setting up, you know, businesses where they're trying to make big money. Immigrants who run... The fruit stands in our neighborhood, if I go on the Upper West Side where affluent white people live, or if I go on Brooklyn Heights where rich white people live, immigrants run them there too. Because the white folks in that community who's interested in business, they're not interested in running a corner store. They're trying to run a Fortune 500 company. Or they're trying to run a Wall Street brokerage firm, or move up in a Wall Street. They're not getting an MBA to run a corner store, you know. So if black people want to run corner stores, you know, then the people who aspire to do that, you know, have to do that. But most black people who are interested in business are not interested in that, you know. They're interested in, you know, other things, you know. So, you know, the thing is, what I'm saying is that it's not just in our community where you see these minorities running these little corner stores. You see them all over. I see them where white people live too. You know, it's just this is we live in a the world that we live in now. You know, is a different world from the world that Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois were arguing about. It's a different world. You know, in America today, when I go to my hometown in St. Augustine, when I left there, it didn't matter what your position was, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, millionaire, whatever, you had to live in Lincolnville. You either had to live in Lincolnville or one other black community on the other side of town. Today, when I go to St. Augustine, black people live wherever they can afford to live. I've written about this. I wrote a piece about Miami. You know, I went down to the community, black community I used to know. It doesn't exist. As a matter of fact, there's a piece called Hanging in the Magic City. You know what I mean? And I go into Miami. I take a real look at Miami, and I talk about how the black communities that I knew in Miami as a kid are gone.
Well, in some of those areas, take in Miami, where you have Little Cuba, and some areas you have Little China, Little Italy, and those kind of communities, would that be self-reliance?
Yeah, but they're all immigrant groups. You understand? I mean, the next generation, the next two generations of these people who become Americans, Marco Rubio, he's not trying to run a rice and bean joint. You understand what I'm saying? Or none of that stuff. He's a senator, he's a United States senator. You know what I mean? If he were in the business, he would be going into a Fortune 500 corporation. These are immigrant businesses. When their kids grow up, they move away from that. And they don't want their kids to be that. They want their kids to be doctors and lawyers and what have you. And so these immigrants have these businesses now, but eventually these communities, when they become integrated into American society, these kids are going to move on off and elsewhere in American society. I mean, you know, most black people who can run a business, most of them don't live in what you think of as what we would say now ghetto communities. They live somewhere else. You know,
they usually establish the business and then hire the local folks to run it.
Well, sometimes they do. You know, if you do that, sometimes they do. But I just don't know a lot of black people who are interested in business, who go to business school, who get MBAs, that's trying to open, you know, no corner store. You know, now, Bruce Llewellyn used to own a chain of supermarkets here.
Who was that?
You
I'm
know,
sorry.
Bruce Llewellyn. What's his name? Adam Clay, Colin Powell's first cousin, you know, he used to own a chain of grocery stores here. And I'm all for people going into business, you know, if that's what they want to do. But what I'm saying is that when Booker T. Washington came along, you know, the black community was an isolated community. You know, it was an isolated community. And the question was, you know, how shall we survive here? And Booker T. Washington never was really talking about preaching black people just doing business with black folk. Booker T. Washington's position was is that, you know, first of all, Tuskegee taught people trades. My Uncle Bernie went to Tuskegee. My Uncle Bernie was a blacksmith, an ironsmith, and a wheelwright. And he worked for he was an independent artisan, and he sold his services to whoever could pay for him.
Well, you know, there were other artisans, so to speak. I'm thinking of Madam C.J. Walker, who built an empire.
Well, Madam C.J. Walker is a different story. Madam C.J. Walker wasn't an artisan. She was a manufacturer.
Okay, manufacturer.
Yeah, she was in manufacturing. She manufactured a hair product. And not only did she manufacture...
The immigrants have came in and taken over that industry now.
That's another whole... I don't really know how... Yeah, but when you say... I mean, I don't really know how that happened. I mean, I'm not an expert, you know, on a business, and I think, you know, you should get somebody who is. I mean, I would recommend... You get Dr. Bernard Anderson. Try to get Dr. Bernard Anderson. He's of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. You know, he's the world's foremost authority on black people in the American economy. I've known him for 50 years, you know, and he's still around there. You know, he may be an emeritus now, but it's the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. You should call and try to get him. He's the one that heads the economic research committee of the Urban League. You know, every year the Urban League puts out a State of Black America report.
Okay.
Well, if you want to really know just how we're doing, get the Urban League State of Black America report. You can audit from them, you know. And there's an economic section in there. And that section is headed by Dr. Bernard Anderson.
What do you think of the three top industries or institutions that W.E. left behind?
Well... First of all, the NAACP.
Okay, that's one.
But W.E.B. Du Bois's legacy is an intellectual legacy. You should get my book. I have a whole section on Du Bois's legacy. You know what I mean? Du Bois's legacy is an intellectual legacy. He is
the
father.
Reconsidering
the Souls of Black Folk.
Okay, Reconsidering the Souls of Black Folk.
Everybody who is writing scientific history of black people owe Du Bois a debt. Everybody who was doing sociology in this country owed Du Bois a debt. Du Bois was also the founder of the Pan-African movement, along with H. Sylvester Williams, and Dr. Alcindor. They called the first Pan-African Congress in 1900. This is before Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey was running around in knee pants in Jamaica. You understand? They called the first Pan-African Congress. And of these five Pan-African Congresses, the fifth one is where Jomo Kenyatta and Kwame Nkrumah and Nnamdi Azikiwe, all the people who came, became the leaders of the first wave of African independence movements. All of them came out of this movement. W.E.B. Du Bois was a great intellectual, you know. His legacy is an intellectual legacy, you know. And also the legacy of black resistance. You know, he was the father of the liberation movement on two continents, you know. So this is Du Bois's legacy in the vast body of scholarship that he left. Booker T. Washington, Tuskegee Institute is still there. You know, it's flourishing.
Yeah.
It's Tuskegee University now. However, when I was down there not too long ago, what I noticed is that what Du Bois and Booker T. Washington were arguing for, neither one of them turned out the way that they thought they would. Tuskegee is a terrible little town. It's in terrible shape. I had never been there before, and I was shocked when I saw it. But the school is thriving. It's fabulous. But the town around it is nothing. It's a little country southern town. You know?
Had a caller sent in an email wanting to know if a school founded by W.E. Du Bois in New Jersey is now a prison. And
I am not aware of Du Bois founding any school in New Jersey.
Okay.
Du Bois was not a founder.
Or maybe it was
the
NAACP.
I'm not aware of the NAACP founding the school. First of all, what I was about to tell you is the reason that Du Bois left the NAACP, the reason he was forced out in 1934, was because Du Bois founded this journal called The Crisis and produced all of this great writing in this. It literally directed the struggle of black America, you know, through this journal. One time, Langston Hughes said that when he was a boy, The Crisis was only the second most popular book to the Holy Bible in the black community. The Bible was first, and The Crisis was second. Right? Well, Du Bois wrote an article in The Crisis in 1934, the title of which was "Does the Negro Still Need Negro Schools?" And he argued in favor of maintaining the black school over integration, and that's what caused him to have to resign from the NAACP, is that he would not budge from that position. And the reason he took that position was he said he thought it was better for black kids to be in school with black teachers who respected and loved them than to be under the tutelage of white teachers who hated them and would kill their spirit.
Okay.
That was his argument, you know, then. But that was, you know, in 1934. As to the question of schools, let me say this about what I think about the problem of education. First of all, the rap against teachers in many instances is unfair. If you don't spend any time with your kid, if you don't teach your kid how to behave, if you don't teach them any manners, if you don't teach them their colors, their numbers, their ABCs, and then you send them to school, and you got one teacher that's got a class or overloaded class or what have you, and you expect this teacher to turn them into savages, and turn them into scholars, these little knuckleheads into scholars. No, you got to be, parents have got to be concerned. Parents have to do their part. You know, I was active in the school that my kids went to. We looked at the schools. We selected them. We were active. We saw to it that they had homework and that they did their homework. And my kids have had no problems being able to pursue what they want to pursue in life. You know, and I know lots of highly successful black people doing all kinds of things. And they didn't come from wealth. A lot of them came from working class and what have you. It is, my brother-in-law is one of the world's foremost authorities on space science, space law. You know, he goes all over the world arguing cases in the world court involving space law, space rights and what have you. He's the son of a coal miner. Father was very poor. William J. Wilson, the great Harvard sociologist, his father was a coal miner. You know, I mean, the main problem we have with education, number one, is a failure of parenting. People don't want to hear this, but it's true. And this is what Bill Cosby was trying to say, but he was saying it badly. You know, and he got a lot of trouble. But I understood what he was trying to say, because Bill Cosby, like, grew up in Philadelphia, you know, and he remembers a time when, like, the Richard Allen projects that he grew up in, a lot of great people came out of those projects. He's just one.
Do you think
and it's because they had parents. They had real parents.
Okay, do you think the schools are being targeted by the charter schools to these whites that are moving back into white neighborhoods or moving into black neighborhoods such as Harlem?
I think this whole charter school, a lot of this whole charter school movement, the whole attempt to take public money and use it in private schools, this began as an attempt of whites to find a way to get their kids out of the public schools after the desegregation decision of Brown in 1955. That's where this really starts. You know, it started in the South, you know, when they started these, what they used to call SEG academies, you know, where the white folks just started putting up money in the opening, you know, calling them Christian schools, whatever.
Hold on,
you know.
Can you hold on a minute, Professor?
Yeah.
I think we have a caller on the line.
Okay.
Hold on a second.
All right.
Are you there, caller?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead. And from where are you calling? What area?
I am calling from Denver, Colorado.
Okay. Go ahead with your...
My name is Arthur McFarlane, and I am the great-grandson of W.E.B. Du Bois.
Oh, wow.
And I would just like to ask Dr. Benjamin to go a little bit further on some of the things that he was saying around the Pan-African movement versus what was going on in the United States and how Grandpa kind of connected those two struggles together, because I think there's a lot of understanding to be gained by taking a look at what he was trying to do in achieving African independence, and at the same time what he was trying to do in the United States using some of the things that he'd learned at the University of Berlin through sociology and study and some of those things. I think he was trying two very different tactics in many ways, but ones that were linked together that should have led us down a different path, I think.
Well,
here's the thing.
What connected them was that black people were oppressed everywhere. In the United States, segregation. In Africa, it was colonization.
Right.
The European, the African nations were colonized by the various European powers. So in my book, for instance, I talk about how Du Bois came to the Pan-African idea. I mean, first of all, the idea first came to him when he was a student in Germany, when he was working on his doctorate in Germany. He studied with Du Bois was in Germany at a time when the Pan-Germanic movement was developing. When there was, you know, talk about, you know, this was a period of intense German nationalism. Du Bois talks about it, you know. He sat in classes with, for instance, these Germans who were theorists of German nationalism. Hold on, somebody's, I don't know, one moment.
Uh-huh. I'm still here.
Okay, you're still on the air.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I think that that Dr. Benjamin is headed down the right path. I think there is a lot to be gained from understanding that as Grandpa is coming out of the Fisk University experience and then the Harvard experience and then going to the University of Berlin, I think what he gets there is exactly as Dr. Benjamin is describing, some tools by which he comes back to the United States and then begins to apply those tools. And I think it's the application of those tools first in the United States and then in this Pan-African movement that bears some examination.
Yeah, but here's the problem. This is what I'm saying. There were two very different problems, you know.
Right.
The African problem and the Afro-American problem were two very different things. But Du Bois felt, like a lot of people felt, first of all, in that period, the oppression was racial. People believed in racial, very deeply believed in racial groups at that time. You have to look at these things, as I say, in the context of the times. They were looked at as the white race and the Negro race. right? So everybody, you know, and it was in all over the world, there was this conflict between the white and the Negro race. So coming up when he did, being a man of great intellect and being in Europe, you know, being in Europe and seeing, you know, the most powerful nation in Europe and witnessing European nationalism, witnessing German nationalism. He talks about it. You know, he saw, you know, the emperor, you know, riding down through the Brandenburg gates. You know, he's standing there. He describes it, you know, with the horses dashing through the gate. He witnessed, you know, German nationalism. The same attitudes that led first to World War I and then to the Nazis. I deal with that, too. You know, how you see these ideas of German romanticism that blossomed into Nazism. The thing about it is, so Du Bois was very much affected by these pan-Germanic romantic ideas. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you somebody else who was affected by it, and that is Robert Herschel, the founder of the modern Zionist movement. In
right.
fact, modern Zionism, Pan-Africanism, and Nazism came from the same intellectual roots in the 19th century German university.
Mm-hmm.
They manifested themselves in different ways, but they had certain common ideals. The
mm-hmm.
idea about the bonding of blood, Blut und Boden, the Germans used to say, blood and land. You see what I'm saying? These were
mm-hmm.
fundamental ideas out of which German nationalism. And so he applied it to the black world. He saw, you know, these pan movements, these pan ethnic movements around, and so he, you know, thought the black world must also unite. However, what we have found out about that since then, this is, we talk about 1900, this is 112 years ago. Since then, we have seen African nations become independent. And we learned a lot of things about them that we didn't know. You know, we hired Dr. Du Bois' wife and his son, Shirley Du Bois and David Du Bois, in the Du Bois Department at Amherst.
Uh-huh.
I had many conversations with her. Plus
right.
all of his papers are there. Right?
Right.
They were surprised
right.
by what actually happened. Because the idea that of a United States of Africa is a pipe dream.
Right.
It's a pipe dream because all of these nations are radically different.
Right.
They have different. They have what we call colonial heritages. The colonial heritage is the first thing that all these countries must deal with. And the colonial heritage is this. The black people in Angola and Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, they live in a Portuguese intellectual world. They speak Portuguese. The writers they read are Portuguese. The political philosophers they read are Portuguese. So they live in a Portuguese intellectual world. The Francophone Africans, the Africans who live in Senegal, who live in Guinea, you know, they live in a French colonial world.
Mm-hmm.
They have a French view. The intellectuals they read, whatever, French. We live in an Anglo world. And we live in not only an Anglo world, but an Anglo-American world. And so
mm-hmm.
we are all quite different. If you read James Baldwin's essay of Princes and Powers about the 1958 Black Writers Conference in Paris,
uh-huh.
when all the black writers of the world got together, these black intellectuals, you can see how different they were. You know,
right.
he talks about the French intellectuals being black intellectuals being French rationalists. You
uh-huh.
know, cold-blooded, logical people. They didn't want to hear nothing about Jesus and all that kind of stuff. And they used to refer to the black Americans as those Bible-thumping black Americans.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we are the only people in the black world who all of our leaders are people of men of the cloth.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether you talk about Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. It's always Minister Farrakhan, you know, Reverend this. You know, there's no other people in the world whose secular leadership is dominated by the clergy. That's a unique Afro-American experience, and there are historical reasons why that's so. But what I'm saying is that Du Bois and them meant well. The great Du Bois was one of the fathers of the Pan-African movement, but the two great theoreticians of Pan-Africanism were C.L.R. James and George Padmore, who were Trinidadians.
Right.
But they were all disciples of W.E.B. Du Bois. All of them.
But then you had to also think about who was actually doing the implementing. And so when the implementers had to take Pan-Africanism back to Africa, and you look at how Kwame Nkrumah did that versus how Jomo Kenyatta did that, then you start to see some of the differences that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, and I'm glad you said took it back to Africa. So that's something
right.
most people don't understand. Right. Pan-Africanism is a concept of New World blacks. You understand what I'm saying? All the great theoreticians of Pan-Africanism are blacks from the New World. You understand what I'm saying? From the United States, from England, from the Caribbean. You know?
Excuse me, Professor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Grandson, could you take off? Do you you have us on speakerphone?
No, I'm using a Bluetooth, though. Would you like me to do differently?
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me. But let me ask you this. Have you ever visited the divorce department in Amherst?
No, I have not.
Because
the head librarian there, and I talked to a number of the professors here, and I actually had gotten an introduction from a history professor who is down at Atlanta University, currently Clark Atlanta, to some folks up at UMass Amherst, and I just have not made the connection that I need to actually get there.
Well, here's the thing. If you go there, all of his papers are there. We made the university buy them and paid his wife a handsome fee for them, too, because we got professional assessors to come in and assess these documents and paid her what they say they were worth. But we needed to get them in a place like a university library so that they would have the proper treatment, you know what I mean? Because, you know, if you don't treat these documents well, they will deteriorate and all kinds of things, you know what I mean? So they needed to be in a professional library that was accessible to people, and we managed to do that, you know, there. But all of his letters and stuff are in there, and it's fascinating, you know what I mean? You should take some time and just go up. Well, I tell you what, I don't know whether you have seen the two-volume work by Dr. David Levering Lewis. Dr. David Levering Lewis's work are the definitive biographies of W.E.B. Du Bois. They're two huge volumes, each one over 500 pages, and they both won the Pulitzer Prize for history. This is unheard of, you know, a black scholar doing a two-volume biography of another black scholar and both volumes winning the Pulitzer Prize. It's unheard of, you know. But it is a fantastic work, and you will see in the footnotes, you know, his constant references to the Du Bois papers, you know, and the many letters and what have you he cites from them. But just in summing up, because I have to go, and, you know, we can do this again sometime. We can do part two of this if you like. But I have to go. But I just want to say that the Niagara Movement was a reaction against the Tuskegee machine, against the domination of Booker T. Washington and his policy of accommodation, both in terms of being willing to give up political rights, any claim on social equality, and exchange, also to settle for a program of education for black youth that was designed toward the trades, you know, farming, agriculture, that kind of thing. Even though scientific agriculture, because I have to say that some of the people who were trained, one of the things Booker T. did was bring Dr. George Washington Carver in, who was a great genius as an agronomist. And the people that he trained, even though they didn't have a chance to fully use all of their training in the United States, they used it elsewhere. For instance, after the Russian Revolution, the Russians brought in a team of black agronomists trained by Dr. George Washington Carver, and they created a special strain of cotton, a special species of cotton, that could grow under the Russian conditions with the short growing season in Russia, and they revolutionized Russian agriculture in other ways. So the Booker T. Washington made a tremendous contribution, and W.E.B. Du Bois was not totally opposed to what he was doing. If you read his critique of Booker T. Washington, his main critique is in an essay entitled "Of Mr. Booker T. Washington and Others." That's
so there was never any really split between the two?
Oh, it was a split. Yes, there was a split, but I'm saying in the beginning, if you read Du Bois' essay, he admired a lot of the things that Booker T. Washington was doing. He understood. He said, look, our people have just, you know, come out of slavery. You know, we're new people. I understand they're going to have to work with their hands. And I understand that it is smart, that it is a good policy to teach them how to work with their hands smartly, how to use what machines they were at the time, how to use the tools, what have you. But he said that cannot be the ultimate aim of black education, because he said that is a philosophy of education that will produce a race of scullions. You know, you will make money makers, but you won't make men. In order to make men, we have to have, first of all, we've got to cultivate our talented test. And this is one of the most misunderstood ideas of all, the idea of the talented test. The idea of the talented test was, is that there's at least one-tenth of our young people who are smart enough to succeed in any academic environment, any environment. You know, they can go right to the top in any environment. And the reason Du Bois knew this was because he was the living proof of it. He was the living proof of it.
And he had friends that were the living proof of it.
Yes, absolutely was. But he himself was. You know,
right.
He didn't have nobody but himself. You know, he was the best example of all his friends. He was the best example, you see, because his mother was a cleaning woman, you know.
Right.
Whose mother was a cleaning woman?
Du Bois' mother was a cleaning woman.
Du Bois, okay.
Yeah, she came from very humble circumstances. He was, you talk about a meritocracy, you know, a person rising on their merits, a self-made man. He was it. You understand what I'm saying? So he understood what education could do, and he understood that in spite of all the racist propaganda about our people not being able to do this and that, he understood that we could do anything, that there were those among us who could do anything, who could compete on the very highest levels. And the idea of the talented 10th was to get an opportunity for this talented 10th among us to do everything. Because he said the role of the talented 10th will be to lead the mass of our people. He said every race advances under the leadership of its exceptional people.
Right.
And the role of exceptional black people was to lead the masses of the people away from the worst in other races and our own. And
I think that's the real difference, though, between Grandpa and Booker T. Washington. I don't know that Booker T. Washington, because of his background, because of the fact that he had come through that slavery experience, I don't think he believed that we could do everything.
Let me tell you something about Booker T. Washington, all right? Booker T. Washington adopted a strategy that allowed him to advance the cause of black people under the conditions he was working under in the black belt in the South. Remember,
like
when I talk about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, for instance, and people read all this rhetoric that Malcolm X was saying, and they talk about how tough Malcolm was. But Malcolm was saying that stuff in New York.
Right.
He wasn't saying it in Mississippi and Alabama.
Right.
He was not down there with Dr. King and them on the front line. See, now when I go down south, for instance, I'm still interviewing right now survivors of the Civil Rights Movement in my hometown. And one of Dr. King's most dangerous campaigns was in St. Augustine, Florida. He talks about it, you know what I'm saying? And I went down there, I'm looking through all of these documents in the archives. Because I had left there by the time he came in. And when I left, I didn't go back for 28 years. I was so disgusted with the South. And when I did go back, and I'm down there, first a colleague of mine at the university, Stephen Oates, wrote a book on Martin Luther King called Let the Trumpet Sound. And when I read this book, a big section of this book was about King's campaigns in St. Augustine, Florida. And the stuff that I was reading in this book, I was absolutely fascinated because I'm seeing people in here who were just ordinary people when I left there, doing all of this heroic stuff. I mean, stuff that was really heroic. So I went down there, and I'm interviewing them, and I'm asking them, where did you get the nerve to do this? And they're telling me about how Dr. Martin Luther King and Jackie Robinson marching side by side with them, basing the Klan, when Malcolm was up here calling out Jackie Robinson and Uncle Tom. You understand? So when you listen to what William Monroe Trotter was in Boston. You understand what I'm saying? Booker T. Washington was in the deep black belt of the South where them crackers would kill you as soon as look at you, right? And so Washington was a very shrewd man. Let me tell you something. Booker T. Washington knew exactly what he was doing. There's only been one other black person in the history of the United States that was as successful in getting rich white people to give him money to do what he wanted to do on behalf of his people. There's only one other black person in American history who can equal Booker T. Washington, and that's the Reverend Dr. Leon Sullivan. And the interesting thing about it is that both he and Booker T. Washington come from West Virginia, as does Tony Brown and Henry Louis Gates. You know, West Virginia black folk have a very interesting tradition. Cotter G. Woodson came from West Virginia. You know, they have this stroke of independence and of great value for education and industry. It's a thrift. They're a fascinating group of people. You know,
I think that's one of the things that's a real knock, though, for Booker T. Washington, because people don't understand how much money white people gave him and how much he ultimately funneled into the grammar school level education of black people, the trade level education of black people throughout the South. I don't think.
But not only that, not only that. Lewis Harlan, who has written a definitive two-volume biography of Booker T. Washington and has gone through all of his papers in the Library of Congress and whatnot. Lewis Harlan found all of these check receipts. Lewis Harlan, H-A-R-L-A-N-D. It's a two-volume work on Booker T. Washington. It's a definitive work. Dr. Harlan found all of these check stubs, receipts, where Booker T. Washington was financing some of these cases that the NAACP was fighting at the same time he was saying that he wasn't down.
Okay, for the grandson, what's your name again, grandson?
My name is Arthur McFarlane.
Arthur McFarlane. Could you finish that thought you just started on?
I know that when a lot of people come to me, and I do a lot of talks around the world about my grandfather, a lot of people think that when you get to this point where Grandpa and Booker T. Washington fall apart, which is about 1903 when Souls of Black Folk is published, that they become these arch enemies. And it is very much like Professor Playful was talking about right now, is that it's really not that kind of a break. It's a break that looks historically like two people butting heads, but it really is two people taking two different tactics to get to the same end. I think
You know what Harold Cruz sums it up?
Mm-hmm.
He says they were not mortal enemies looking at two different things. He said this was a fight among the emerging black bourgeoisie over which tactics would best advance the race. And that's a very good example. That's a very good summation of what was actually going on. You're right about that. It was a far more complex and nuanced. For instance, Booker T. Washington was married to Du Bois's classmate, and he tried to get her to talk Du Bois into coming to Tuskegee. And he told Du Bois, he said, "Listen, you come to Tuskegee, you ain't got to worry about trying to get these white folks to publish your book. I got a printing press. I'll publish them right here."
He had already accepted the job of Wilberforce.
We have another caller on the line.
Well, that was after the Wilberforce thing. The reason he didn't go to Tuskegee is because Booker T. Washington, he had to accept Booker T. Washington's philosophy, hook, line, and sinker, and become a ghostwriter for Booker T. Washington. He didn't
want to do that. We have another caller on the line.
All right, okay, but I got to go soon, so this will be the last caller, and we'll have to do this again.
We will do this again, Professor. And Arthur, we'd like to have you on as a guest one day as well.
That would be just fine.
Okay. Let me see if this caller is still here. You still there, caller?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Okay. Could you give us your name and whatever?
My name is, I'm calling from New Orleans, and I refer to myself as Brother Warren because I also have a show on Blog Talk. But the topic I thought was very intriguing. And when you talk about Booker T. Washington, I'm 43 years old. But all of the elders in my family were Booker T. disciples. And there's a picture of my great-great-grandfather's sister with Booker T. Washington in 1915 when he did a Louisiana tour. But one of the things that one of the best analyses of Booker T. Washington I've seen is in a book called The Crisis of the Black Intellectual by W.D. Wright.
Yes, The Crisis of the Black Intellectual. Wow, I'm not familiar. I'm familiar with The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual by Harold Cruz, which is a masterpiece.
This is a 50-page discussion on Booker T. and how black people have overlooked Booker T.'s important role. But one of the things I never forget my great-uncle telling me was that as they talked about the NAACP, when it was founded in New Orleans, was that a group, basically, the way they looked at it, as I was hearing in my family, a group of liberal whites did not want blacks to compete with whites in general on the economic front, economic level.
Well, the white people who founded it,
the NAACP was founded to stop Booker T. Washington.
Say that again?
That my understanding with information that's coming out, and that the NAACP, and even they themselves say that some of them, like Monroe Trott and others, was founded to stop Booker T. Washington
Okay.
and what he was doing.
any kind of economic thing. That's not the point at all. The NAACP was started as a result of the bloody, murderous riot that killed a whole lot of black people in Springfield, Illinois in 1908.
Right.
Springfield, Illinois was the hometown of Abraham Lincoln. All right? This was a race war going on. You understand? There's no question about trying to stop the black people from doing it. That's ridiculous. That has nothing to do with it. They call this because they felt that we've got to stop this burgeoning race war in this country, and we need to have an organization that can really speak for black people in the courts, because the NAACP, from the very beginning, was an organization that sought to change the law. Because after all is said and done, you can say whatever you want to say, but until you change the law, it don't mean nothing. You understand what I'm saying? That's why before he died, the great lawyer Thurgood Marshall said, look, Martin Luther King was very important, but he didn't desegregate anything. The lawyers in the NAACP desegregated America, and they did. Right?
This is a very complex. I've got an email here.
Yeah.
Someone wanting to know why W.E. split with the NAACP.
To the 1934 essay that he wrote, Does the Negro Still Need Negro Schools? I told you that earlier. He was forced out after he wrote that piece in favor of black schools, because NAACP was trying to integrate schools. And Du Bois began to have second thoughts about it, you know. And he wrote this essay, Does the Negro Still Need Negro Schools? And the answer was yes. And they say, look, you can't be saying this, you know, and you are, you know, the editor of our journal, you know what I mean? Our position is, you know, a position on integration, and Du Bois refused to change it, you know, so he had to resign.
Don't you think that was just sort of a straw that broke the camel's back? I think there were a lot of disagreements between Grandpa and Walter White and a number of other people.
Oh, yeah,
there
were disagreements between him and Walter White. Yeah, it were. I mean, that's, you know, but the issue that led him being resigned, specific issue was over this issue. Yes,
right.
He had a lot of disagreements with Walter White. First of all, Walter White looked like a white man, you know, and Du Bois was convinced that affected the way he saw things, because he would look like a white man, and he was married to a white woman. You understand what I'm saying? However, he was a heroic figure, because Walter White used to go down in the South, and because he was from the South, he was from Atlanta, and he knew how to talk like the crackers and whatnot. When there was a big lynching, he used to go right down there into the town where the lynching took place, hang out with them crackers, you know, drinking corn liquor and stuff until he found out who the lynchers were and turned their information, you know, over to the FBI and what have you. And turned it over to the authorities, you know, and put it in the newspaper, expose them. Walter White, and so they were looking out for him. They were on the lookout. They were all over the South. These crackers say, you know, they were going to shoot on sight if they found Walter White. And he would put on all these different disguises and go. So Walter White was a hell of a guy. You should read his autobiography, which is entitled A Man Called White. You know, Yes, a hell of a book. You know what I mean? A hell of a, talking about adventure story is a great book. But Du Bois and Walter White had several arguments, because Walter White was a total integrationist. And you see, this is where people make a mistake about Du Bois. You know what I mean? When most people, when they talk about the nationalists and the integrationists, they put, for instance, Marcus Garvey on one side and Du Bois on the other. But Du Bois had very distinct nationalist feelings before Marcus Garvey was born. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, Du Bois, if you look at the leading authority on black nationalism in the United States, Professor Wilson Jeremiah Moses, you know, you look at his work, you'll see, like The Golden Age of Black Nationalism, or Classical Black Nationalism, or On the Wings of Ethiopia. I mean, you look at these books, these studies by really, he's a brilliant historian, Wilson Jeremiah Moses, and he puts Du Bois in a category that he calls mystical Ethiopianist. You understand what I'm saying? That he was also, you know, that he had very strong, Du Bois was a real race man. You know, there's no other way to describe it. You know, but nevertheless, he thought that our people should have all the rights to do whatever they wanted to do.
Professor Benjamin,
yeah.
We're running out of time here right now.
Call me again and we'll do it again. Yeah.
We will, but before you go, I want to say this has been extremely educational. I feel like
I should
be getting some college credit for this. So,
thank you.
But I want, before you leave, I want you to give us a list of the books that you mentioned that you think our audiences should be involved with. And Mr. McFarland, can we get your permission to call and schedule an interview?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, if you want to look at these particular issues I'm talking about here now, first of all, a good overall history of black Americans with all this in it is John Hope Franklin's From Slavery to Freedom.
Right. Slavery to Freedom, okay.
If you're going to get one book, you know, and read through all of it, there are two volumes written by Dr. David Levering Lewis on W.E.B. Du Bois. You know, if you read these books, you will, I mean, not only will you know everything about Du Bois, but you will know a whole lot about black people in the world in the 20th
century. And
David
also put together a reader that went along with those two biographies, too, and it's just called W.E.B. Du Bois, A Reader. And so if you want to actually read some of the things that Grandpa wrote that Lewis is using as references, you can get that, too.
Yeah. Well, David was up in Amherst right there where the papers are. You know what I mean? So he was working in them too. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. There's a whole collection of Du Bois' books himself. You know what I'm saying? Now, there's a collection of his writings put out by the University of Massachusetts Press. You know? And these are the unpublished writings of W.E.B. Du Bois. You just call the University of Massachusetts Press and you can see them from different periods. You know what I mean? Collections of his work. An overall analysis of the arguments with Du Bois and David Levering Lewis covers it all. But if you read Harold Cruz's The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, particularly when he's talking about black nationalism, he's talking about Booker T. Washington and Du Bois, he has some interesting things to say about it. But the definitive books are David Levering Lewis's books. Read Dr. Du Bois' autobiography, Dusk of Dawn.
Right.
In fact, he wrote three autobiographies.
You said Dusk of Dawn?
Dusk of Dawn. That's the one, D-U-S-K of Dawn, D-A-W-N. And then there's the autobiography of W.E.B. Du Bois, which is written later, you know.
And then there's Dark Water.
There's but The Souls of Black Folk, you know.
Right.
Also want to read The Souls of Black Folk. We've been talking about it, published in 1903. You can read my book, Reconsidering the Souls of Black Folk. Deals with these questions.
Where's your book available, Professor?
Well, just go on Amazon.
Amazon? Okay.
Yeah, Reconsider the Soul, Place of Benjamin and Stanley Crouch. And then the books on, you should read Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery. See, the fascinating thing is, reading these people's autobiographies, you know, is a good place to get into to get their story. Walter White, A Man Called White, W.E.B. Du Bois, Dusk of Dawn, an autobiography of W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, Up From Slavery, Frederick Douglass, The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass. All of these books, at this stage of the game, the scholarship on Afro-Americans is formidable. You know, I mean, it used to be just a few books, but there are lots of books now, you know. The dilemma of the African American intellectual by Jenkin is another one that's an interesting book. Get From Slavery to Freedom, Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, the autobiographies I mentioned.
Okay.
And if you really want to do some heavy reading, get David Levering Lewis's biographies of Du Bois. And Wilson Jeremiah Moses on the Wings of Ethiopia, you know, it's the classical black nationalism. All of these works. When I come back again, I'll make out a list. So I wasn't thinking about, you know, I just mentioned these books off the top of my head. It's like second nature to me, you know. But when I come on again, I'll make a list.
Yes, I know.
I'll make a list.
New Yorkers are very fast.
Well, I'm actually from Florida. You know,
oh, okay.
I've been living here for some years. I've been living in the same place for almost 35 years. I grew up in Florida, you know, and I notice when I go down there, it is noticeably slower, you know. And a lot of it is because of the heat, you know, in the South. People just move slower, you know. But anyway,
okay.
It's been a pleasure. And,
gentlemen, we're
coming
to an end. Would either of you like to have a parting word?
Well, I'll just say it's been a pleasure being here, and call me again, and we'll do it again.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
It's been great to listen to you, Professor. I think it's always interesting to learn a little bit more, and I know a lot about my grandfather, but I'm not an expert on him, so it's always great to hear another perspective.
Are you on Facebook?
Yes, I am.
Well, friend me on Facebook.
Okay, I'll do that.
All right, and we can talk. Okay, see you later.
And so will we, Mr. McFarland.
Sounds great.
Okay, my name is Preston Washington.
Okay.
And you might hear from Leslie Gist, G-I-S-T.
Okay.
Okay? Thank you, gentlemen. Again,
Thank you very much.
I should be getting credit, college credit for this tonight.
Yeah.
Very informative.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, good night. And
good night.
A gentleman from New Orleans, if you're still there. And we're off the air.